This is Pacifica Radio's Letters on Politics. On today's show,
they got a warrant on someone in the Trump campaign using opposition research paid for by the Democratic Party and the Hillary Clinton campaign. That's what this is about.
That's Chair of the House Intelligence Committee, Devin Nunes, about his memo that was declassified late last week. Today, the committee votes on whether to release an opposing Democratic memo. We are going to take a step back and we're going to be talking about these FISA courts, what they are and what their history is. Our guest is Mel Goodman. He is a former CIA operative and director of the National Security Project at the Center for International Policy. Then in the second half of today's program, we'll be joined by journalist Pat Thomas and talking about the 1960s activist turned investor, Jerry Rubin. Pat Thomas is the author of the book, Did It, From Yippie to Yuppie, Jerry Rubin, an American Revolutionary. That's next on Letters and Politics. But first, the news.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. The House Intelligence Committee meets today and could vote to release the Democrats' rebuttal to the Republican-produced memo made public last Friday. Donald Trump tweeted an attack on the ranking committee Democrat this morning. Trump tweeted, quote, "Little Adam Schiff is one of the biggest liars and leakers in Washington, and he said Schiff must be stopped." Schiff responded that Trump's attack on him amounts to false smears and said, quote, "Mr. President, I see you've had a busy morning of executive time. Instead of tweeting false smears, the American people would appreciate it if you turned off the TV and helped solve the funding crisis, protected Dreamers, or really anything else," Schiff tweeted. This weekend, Schiff said the aim of the Republican memo was to protect Trump.
"The goal here really isn't to find out the answers from the FBI. The goal here is to undermine the FBI, discredit the FBI, discredit the Mueller investigation, do the president's bidding."
The memo released Friday accuses the FBI and Justice Department of improperly using information from a Christopher Steele dossier to obtain surveillance warrants on former Trump campaign official Carter Page. A bipartisan immigration proposal has surfaced in the Senate, only to be quickly knocked down by Donald Trump via Twitter. Republican Senator John McCain and Democratic Senator Chris Coons plan to propose legislation that would shield from deportation young undocumented immigrants who entered the U.S. as children. The bill also would strengthen border security, but it would not provide the $25 billion Trump has demanded for an expanded border wall. Before the Senate had a chance to consider the plan, Trump seemed to reject it. He tweeted this morning, quote, "Any deal on DACA that does not include strong border security and the desperately needed wall is a total waste of time. March 5th is rapidly approaching and the Dems seem not to care about DACA. Make a deal," Trump tweeted. Minneapolis police arrested 17 activists who blocked a light rail line carrying Super Bowl ticket holders to the stadium. It was a protest against police brutality and more. The activists wore sweatshirts saying, "You can't play with black lives," as they read aloud the names of black people killed by police officers.
Divestment from the deadly systems of oppression that harm black people."
A Metro Transit spokesperson said all 17 were cited for unlawful interference with transit and released. The protest shut down service for 2 hours. In Philadelphia, Eagles fans celebrated the team's Super Bowl win. In the streets, some flipped cars, smashed windows, set fires, toppled traffic lights, and climbed onto a hotel awning, causing it to collapse. No word on how many injuries there were or an estimate of the cost of damage. Police reported 3 arrests. Federal investigators say a deadly crash between a freight train and a passenger train in South Carolina was preventable. A conductor and an engineer died when the Amtrak train ended up on the wrong track and slammed into a freight train, 116 people suffered injuries. The chair of the National Transportation Safety Board said a switch was in the wrong position and that a GPS-based system called Positive Train Control could have prevented the crash. It was the third deadly wreck involving Amtrak in 3 months. Syrian activists say civilians have suffered chlorine gas poisoning during an attack on a rebel-held town in Idlib province. The Syrian American Medical Society says its hospitals in the area treated 11 patients for chlorine gas poisoning. The attacks and their source were not independently confirmed. The Norwegian Refugee Council and other international aid groups say they worry large numbers of Syrian refugees are being pushed to return home while their war-ravaged country remains unsafe. The report says in the first 9 months of last year, 2.4 million Syrians fled their homes. Jan Eglin heads the Refugee Council.
I think the pressure across the Middle East and in Europe and elsewhere is to tell Syrian refugees, now you should return. This is the time to go back, and not consulting them, not informing them, and especially not looking at the real conditions in Syria.
In 7 years of war, some 5.5 million Syrians have fled their homes. Millions more were internally displaced. I'm Eileen Alfandary. Letters and Politics is next.
Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. The House Intelligence Committee today is expected to vote on whether or not to declassify a memo that was written by Democrats as a response to the memo released late last week by Republican chair of the committee, Devin Nunes. Nunes' memo now suggested that the FBI's investigation into the Trump campaign in 2016 was fraudulent from the very beginning. Now, this whole story reveals around what is known as FISA courts that operate in secret, in which both the Department of Justice and the FBI have to go through to get permission in order to conduct surveillance of U.S. citizens. Well, today we want to take a step back and talk about what these FISA courts are and the history behind them and why we got them to begin with. Joining me on the telephone is Mel Goodman. Now, Mel Goodman served as a senior analyst and division chief at the CIA from 1966 to 1990. He is now the director of the National Security Project at the Center for International Policy in Washington, D.C., and he is the author of a number of books. His latest is called Whistleblower at the CIA, an insider's account of the politics of intelligence. Mel Goodman, always a very good pleasure to talk to you, sir.
Thank you, Mitch. Good to be with you again.
So let's begin here, I guess, with the information that we received from the Nunes memo that was released late last week, and then we'll dive into the history of the FISA courts. But let's go to the particulars that people are talking about right now. I want to know what you think. Now, this Nunes memo released last week states that in obtaining a warrant in order to conduct surveillance of Carter Page, that it presented as evidence the Steele memo, the Christopher Steele memo. I'm also going to ask you about Christopher Steele here in a moment, too. But what it says, this memo says, is that it never pointed out that this Steele memo was actually, in part anyways, paid for by the DNC, by Democrats, and had a political bent to it that the surveillance court, the judge, never was told about. What's your take on all this?
Well, I think my first reaction is someone who has spent 42 years with security clearances, including 24 years at the CIA, is that the Nunes memo is a classic example of cherry-picking intelligence. Obviously, they've pulled various facts out of the background, out of some of the documentation, out of some of the testimony, to make the case that this was a fraudulent use of the FISA court, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act court. And we're learning, as a result of leaks, that there was a lot of information that the Nunes memo did not touch on at all. For example, the Nunes memo says that the deputy Attorney General McCabe had testified that without the Steele dossier, they never would have gotten, they never would have gone to the FISA court to try to get a warrant to surveil Page, Carter Page. Well, apparently that's not true, that it wasn't the Steele dossier. It was the fact that Papadopoulos, someone who worked for the Trump campaign and is now cooperating with the Mueller probe and the investigation of the Trump campaign is the one who told an Australian diplomat in London that Carter Page is someone who was working with the Russians, and there was some reason to think that he was getting information that dealt with Hillary Clinton's emails for the Trump campaign. So the Steele dossier, whatever you want to think of it, is not the reason why the FISA court gave approval on four different times. That's important to recognize, too. The FISA court gives a warrant that allows you to surveil an American citizen for 90 days. At the end of that 90 days, you have to renew the warrant. And it's kind of interesting that if you look at the various attempts to get a warrant to look at Carter Page, and all were successful, all four, they were signed by five different people. Comey signed three of them. McCabe signed one. Sally Yates signed one. Bente signed one. And so did Rosenstein. Of those five, four have already been forced out one way or another from the Department of Justice or the FBI. Comey, of course, was removed. McCabe was forced to retire early. Sally Yates was moved out. And Bente was moved out, then brought back, and then moved out again. So only Rosenstein remains. So with this cherry-picked intelligence, it begs to the argument, or begs the question of, well, what about the response? What about the Democratic memo that tries to put into context what is the factual basis, what is the evidentiary basis of this attempt to get warrants on Carter Page, and what are we really dealing with here? My problem with all of this is it's clearly a politicization of the Department of Justice. It's a politicization of the FBI. Donald Trump and his minions, including Devin Nunes, the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, are really trying to defend the president. They're not trying to protect the Constitution. They're not trying to defend the national security of the United States. They're not trying to protect the integrity of the Justice Department or the FBI. They're trying to protect Donald Trump. And when you're sworn in to these institutions, as I was at CIA or as I was at the Department of Defense or Department of State, your allegiance is to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States, not the President of the United States. So what we're seeing here is an incredible example of politicization. Now, let me say something about the FISA court, because I think your audience needs to understand that. The FISA court was created in the late 1970s. I think it was 1978. It was
78.
The Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act that created the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Courts. And it was created because during the Vietnam War, there was tremendous abuse by the intelligence community of the civil rights of American citizens. There were mail openings, there was illegal surveillance, there was illegal wiretaps. All of the things that we're talking about now really had its origin during the Vietnam War and the administrations of not one but two presidents. Lyndon Johnson started a lot of this. Richard Nixon made it worse. So,
and we'd include COINTELPRO in all of that.
That's the programs were under COINTELPRO, is a counterintelligence program run by the FBI, the National Security Agency, and the CIA. All took part of this, all violating the constitutional amendment, the Fourth Amendment, against illegal searches and seizures. And particularly for an organization like the CIA, which should have nothing to do with domestic intelligence gathering anyway, and that the same can be said for the National Security Agency, these were tremendous illegal and unconstitutional violations.
Were they conducting surveillance without any kind of warrant?
They were conducting surveillance without warrants of the anti-war movement.
Yeah.
They were conducting a lot of surveillance of Martin Luther King and his so-called connections to communist powers, an attempt to compromise Martin Luther King. This was a real obsession with J. Edgar Hoover. But my concern now is that we need to know more about the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. So what this Republican memo could lead to when we get beyond where we are now with the investigation of the Trump campaign and possible collusion with Russia, which we still don't know a lot, is the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court merely a rubber stamp for the Department of Justice and the FBI? And I think the Republican memo has, you know, raised that issue, because the last time I looked into this, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, the FISA court, had approved, I don't know, 4,500 to 5,000 warrants of this type to allow surveillance. And maybe had denied about a dozen of these applications. So it begs the question of whether this court is a rubber stamp for the Justice Department. But to claim that the Justice Department is trying to embarrass or compromise a Republican president, it really is just counterintuitive. I was in the national security community, as I said, one way or another for 42 years. This is a very conservative community. I wasn't ever a member of the FBI, but I used to brief FBI officers in their training programs on a regular basis. And when you got to know FBI people at a senior level, these are very conservative individuals, typically members of the, you know, supporters of the Republican Party. I'm not saying that that made a difference in terms of how they did their work, but these are not Democrats. These are not great liberals. These are not great progressives.
And if you
others,
yeah,
Rosenstein, they're all Republicans.
But I know that, and you're right to point that out. But I think what Trump and Trump supporters would say, they may be Republicans, but they're also part of the establishment. They're part of, and I don't mean to get too sidetracked here, but they would say deep state. And I don't want to go down the road of deep state here, but that's kind of what they say. They may be Republicans, but they're also part of the establishment.
Response, but the whole notion of a deep state, anyone who's worked in the government knows that that is particularly ludicrous, that there's a deep state that involves cooperation between the FBI and the State Department and the military and the CIA to challenge the President of the United States. You know, the government just doesn't work that way. You know, of all the conspiracy notions that have come around in the recent past, this just shows that liberals can be as stupid as conservatives in how they think about conspiracy. So I think that the whole notion of the deep state makes no sense whatsoever.
I mean, for me, it would be just what the bureaucracy is. And when you go into any kind of organization or whatever, you have people who have been running it for many years who sort of are running it. I mean, I don't see it as a conspiracy, as just how kind of things seem to work. I think it happens anywhere you go. The people who have been there for a while know how things operate and end up having influence. Mel Goodman, I want to get back to the Carter Page the FISA court in allowing the FBI to do surveillance of Carter Page. I tend to think that, and this gets to your point of, is the FISA court just, you know, using a rubber stamp and approving all of these requests for surveillance? I think there is a point to be said that, hey, you know, maybe, and I guess it's in dispute whether or not the FBI did provide information about who was funding the Steele memo. But let's say there was nothing and they didn't inform the judge about who was behind this Steele dossier. I actually think then they have a point for in saying that should have been brought up and a judge should have been told that. But again, back to this issue of rubber stamping, I suspect that even if they did tell the judge, they probably still would have got the approval to do the surveillance.
Well, the reason why they got the approval to do the surveillance had nothing to do with the Steele dossier. I think we know that. It was Papadopoulos who's now cooperating with the government, the government's investigation of this entire issue. His remarks that were made to an Australian diplomat in London in 2016, and that is the decisive event that I think led to the FBI asking for this warrant. Remember, their knowledge of Carter Page goes back about 5 years to 2013. Now, I have another issue that I think liberals and progressives should really be concerned about, and that is, who is Carter Page? Was there a warrant made to surveil him because he took positions that were similar to positions taken by Vladimir Putin? I've taken positions in lectures that are somewhat sympathetic of Putin's positions on various issues. I am someone who used to travel to the Soviet Union and to Russia on a regular basis. I am someone who's had contact with certain Russian officials on some of these visits. Does that mean I should come up on the radar of the FBI to allow the FISA court to surveil my activities? So One of the things about the Republican memo that disturbs me is there's a certain amount of guilt by association, a certain amount of McCarthyism, and how Carter Page has been identified. Now, Carter Page, if he's an agent working for the Russians and trying to solidify contacts between the Trump campaign and the Russians, is a very peculiar chap to be doing this. He doesn't seem like a very capable individual to begin with. There's one intercept that I've seen in which Russian agents who were dealing with Carter Page referred to him as an idiot, but that they were going to keep talking to him. And that's the Luke Harding book on collusion is a tremendous source of information on the whole Carter Page issue. So we really don't know a lot about Carter Page, but I think if the FISA court did renew this warrant three different times after the original approval, my guess is there's some evidence here. And certainly the Trump campaign has been going out of its way to try to de-emphasize or dismiss any contact or role that Page had with the campaign, when the fact is Trump referred to him on several occasions as a foreign policy advisor to the campaign. So Carter Page is a very mysterious character. I hope the FBI has some reason for asking for these warrants four different times. And my guess is they did. And the Steele dossier really had very little to do with that. Christopher Steele himself is someone who has received money from the FBI to provide information to the FBI. He was an agent with MI6, British Intelligence, the counterpart of CIA's clandestine activities division. He was well known to the intelligence community, and his dossier, even though, again, it was motivated by a concern about who was Donald Trump, and it was funded originally not by Democrats or Hillary Clinton's campaign, it was funded by a Republican organization that was trying to stop Donald Trump from getting the nomination of the Republican Party for the presidency of the United States. So it went through several tranches of funding before the Democrats and Hillary Clinton's campaign picked up the ball. Now, my understanding is, and the Democratic memo will say this, that the FISA court did not get all of the information about the political motivations of the Steele dossier, but they did have the understanding that there was a political motivation in all of this activity. That doesn't mean that these politically motivated information wasn't accurate. That we just don't know. And my guess is there are multiple sources. Remember, there is a lot of material that the Mueller investigation has, intercept material, intercepts by the CIA of foreign intelligence, intercepts by the National Security Agency of any American who contacted a Russian official. And that would be, obviously, if people high up in the Trump campaign, including General Michael Flynn, who had numerous conversations with the Russian ambassador Kislyak. So my guess is there's a hell of a lot more information out there that we just haven't seen yet. And the problem with counterintelligence investigations, and we learned this during Iran-Contra, is they take years. The Iran-Contra investigation went on for 6 years. I'm not saying this investigation is going to last that long, but the longer it goes on, I think the more easily you will be able to challenge the integrity and credibility of this investigation. And I think that's what Trump has done and Nunes have done with this memo. They have tried to show that there's an element of bias in this investigation. And I'm reading the 3.5-page memo. You have to wonder about the FBI agent Strozak and his anti-Trump comments, his email exchanges with Lisa Page, the fact that these two high-ranking FBI agents were carrying on an affair and making all sorts of in-politic remarks about the campaign, about Hillary Clinton and about Donald Trump, which I think compromises the investigation. I give Mueller credit for moving Strozak and Page aside as soon as he learned about this, but it does taint the investigation. It does raise the issue of bias. McCabe has his own problem. Here's a deputy attorney general whose wife was running for a Democratic office in the state of Virginia and receiving $500,000 from the governor of Virginia, who's very close to the Clinton campaign. Well, I think McCabe, he should have recused himself immediately once he said it was okay for his wife to receive this kind of funding from Governor McAuliffe in Virginia. And then we found out there's another FBI officer whose wife actually worked for the Fusion Group that was working on the Steele dossier and was helping to fund the Steele dossier. So I think what the Republican memo has done is thrown a lot of dust in the air, and it's going to cloud the vision of a lot of people and make it sound like a he said, she said kind of exchange between Democrats and Republicans. And I think it's going to compromise the investigation over the long run.
You do. You think it will compromise. You think it's inevitable now.
I think Trump is being successful here in terms of yelling about fake news. In my own lectures that I give, particularly in support of my recent book, people really don't know what to believe anymore. They don't see any great credibility anywhere. So I think Trump has been very successful in this bias campaign that he's waging, and I think Nunes has clearly lent himself to this.
And Mel, I just want to get this down, Mel Goodman, that it seems to me that, A, you think that the investigation itself is a valid investigation that could occur, while at the same time you think you have seen some fraudulent actions within the investigation, which I guess is
well,
normal.
I don't know if I'd use the word fraudulent, but I've seen some actions that have not been professional. McCabe's failure to recuse himself was not professional. Orr's standing as an associate deputy attorney general, whose wife was with the Fusion GPS group, which was doing essentially opposition research against Donald Trump that was funded by Republican organizations originally before it was funded by Democratic organizations, that wasn't professional. And then, of course, Strozak, the FBI agent with the compromising emails to his mistress, he's the link to both Steele and to Papadopoulos. He's the one who led the counterintelligence interview with Papadopoulos, in which Papadopoulos lied to the FBI, which made him vulnerable to prosecution by the FBI. So there are a lot of bizarre angles to all of this that really, unfortunately, taint this investigation that's being done by one of the most professional people we have in the United States government, and that happens to be Robert Mueller.
But I mean, it seems like we're getting... It seems like we're just getting to many sensitive issues within the state and its law enforcement apparatus of surveillance and investigation and what you can do and what you can't do. And we're getting into some serious things, as you mentioned already, including questions as to whether or not, you know, the FISA courts just rubber stamp everything that comes to their desk. At the same time, it's so politicized. I guess the question is, are we really getting to the heart of how government is acting?
Well, I think there are two different issues here. There's the issue of the Trump campaign and their connections to Russian officials and the involvement of Russia in the campaign. But then you have another serious set of issues that are going to have to be dealt with over the long run, dealing with the political process, with how the government investigates matters involving U.S. citizens. And remember, whenever, and General Eisenhower, President Eisenhower warned about this, whenever you're in a condition of permanent war, civil liberties and political liberty tends to get compromised. We saw this during the Vietnam War when we were in permanent war for a dozen years. We've been involved in war since 2001. The Afghan War is in its 16th, 17th year, and we've lost a lot of liberty in that period. We have seen our civil rights compromised. We've seen the National Security Agency surveil American citizens. That's a direct repudiation of the charter of the National Security Agency.
Well, even the Patriot Act.
The director of the National Security Agency, yeah. Michael Hayden, involved in this, and then he becomes the director of the CIA, where he's involved in torture and abuse and these illegal renditions that the United States was conducting over a serious period of time until they were stopped by the Obama administration. So there's a lot we need to learn that is separate from the Trump connections to Russia that should concern genuine conservatives as well as liberals and progressives.
The Patriot Act, I mean, you talk about permanent war, the Patriot Act, my understanding, changed significantly the FISA Act and took away some of the safeguards that were inherent in it.
Well, the Patriot Act could not have been passed without the 9/11 attacks. And this was a clear case of the country shooting itself in the foot because it was so frightened by the attacks that took place in September 2001. And clearly, they added to the problem by allowing the FBI to go to doctors' offices to get records of patients, to go to libraries to find out what people were reading. This was a tremendous violation of civil liberties, which is exactly what Eisenhower was talking about. And if you look at the Federalist Papers, it's what James Madison wrote about in the Federalist Papers, again, in terms of permanent war leading to compromises of civil liberties. And I think what Nunes is tapping into is the cynicism of the American people about our own government. And when you look at the misuse of military force, the way we went to war, the way we lied to go to war against Iraq, when you look at the defense budget now that Trump wants to increase, the return to finding uses for nuclear weapons, this is creating tremendous cynicism among the American people about just the reliability and accountability of our own government.
That's interesting. Mel, we're almost out of time, but it sounds like through all these misactions that our government has taken in the past, the war in Iraq, the trampling of civil liberties, all these things has created this cynicism about government in this country that perhaps a demagogue can exploit.
Well, I think it's the cynicism that led to his election in the first place. I think if people had not been so cynical about government, more people would have voted. Progressives would have voted for Hillary Clinton, realizing that whatever her problems were, she was a better candidate than Donald Trump. And now they've elected not only a demagogue, but an authoritarian. And these cynics, to a great degree, still support him. That's worrisome.
Mel Goodman, I thank you. As always.
Thank you, Mitch. Good to be with you.
Good to have you on. Mel Goodman has been our guest. Again, Mel Goodman was a senior analyst and division chief of the CIA from 1966 to 1990. He is now the director of the National Security Project at the Center for International Policy in Washington, D.C., and he is also author of the book Whistleblower at the CIA, an insider's account of politics of intelligence. You are listening to Letters on Politics. When we come back from this short musical break, we'll be in conversation with journalist Pat Thomas. And we'll be talking about the iconic 60s activist turned investor, Jerry Rubin. Stay tuned. And you are listening to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jesrich. And we're now going to turn into some history, but maybe perhaps recent history, at least second half of the 20th century, and look at Jerry Rubin. Jerry Rubin was co-founder, along with Abby Hoffman, of the radical group in the 1970s, the Yippies. He was also a controversial person, especially among the left, because he would end up becoming very successful in business. He would go from a Yippie to a Yuppie. In fact, that is even part of the title of the book of who we're about to speak with, and that is Pat Thomas. Pat Thomas has written a book about Jerry Rubin. It's called Did It? From Yippie to Yuppie, Jerry Rubin, an American revolutionary. Pat Thomas, it's my very good pleasure to welcome you to our radio station. Thank you for being here today.
Well, thank you. You know, Berkeley is where Jerry got his start as a radical, as an activist. So it's appropriate that I'm here.
He ran for mayor.
He did run for mayor, and he had an incredible platform that ranged not only from marijuana reform, But he had thoughts on China and Asia, you know, which, you know, for a mayor of Berkeley, like, who would care? But, you know, Jerry was, he was thinking big.
What did he get, 20% of the vote? Somewhere around there?
Something like that. Yeah, he did pretty good. This 1966, I believe. Yeah.
This is one of those shows and one of these interviews in which I am sure my audience, a good number of people in the audience, know who Jerry Rubin is. But Jerry Rubin is one of the shows where that, but he was before my time. I mean, I was born in the 70s, but I you know, wasn't conscious of what was going on politically around that time. So just for context, tell me about Jerry Rubin, just for a place to jump off here. Jerry Rubin, Abbie Hoffman, and the Yippies.
The Yippies were basically politicized hippies. And so, you know, they were against the war in Vietnam. They were friends and very close with the Black Panthers. LBJ, Nixon, and Hoover were their enemies. But what they did is they used sort of guerrilla theater and outrageous tactics, you know, kind of sex, drugs, rock and roll, and humor to rope in, you know, people between the ages of, let's say, 16 and 30 and kind of, you know, radicalize them against the Vietnam War.
Television was important. And getting covered in television.
Well, they were, you know, they were master manipulators. You know, they announced in Chicago in 1968 that they were going to bring enough LSD to dose the entire water supply of Chicago. Now, everyone believed that. Later, someone figured out it would have taken 5.5 tons, which right. Obviously they didn't have. But they knew how to get front page news, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was important to be covered. I mean, that was the idea. It was very image driven, wasn't it?
It was very image driven. Again, you know, sort of shocking. But you know, they did some incredible things. Their first act of defiance was, you know, I like to say it would take a nuclear bomb to shut down the New York Stock Exchange. They shut it down by throwing $500 worth of $1 bills on the trading floor, and all the traders stopped trading. And
they did. Yeah. They really did, just to get these $1 bills.
Yeah, just to get these $1 bills. So they did something that I don't think anyone else has ever done. They shut down the New York Stock Exchange for a couple of hours.
You want to get any video of that?
There's not video, but there's some photographs.
Uh-huh.
The other thing they did is they surrounded the Pentagon in October of 67 and said, we're going to levitate it by chanting. You know, Daniel Ellsberg was there and McNamara were there sort of watching that. And there was even this proving the truth is always stranger than fiction. Before they did this so-called levitation, a week before, they met with the National Park Service to discuss how many feet off the ground that they could legally levitate.
That's was Abbie Hoffman more well-known, more well-remembered?
Well, Abby's better known because, you know, Abbie became mythological. You know, Abbie went underground in the 70s on a drug charge. You know, Abbie never shaved off his beard, never put on a tie. And so Abbie is, you know, like I said, he's become this mythological character. One of the reasons I wrote the book is that a lot of people think that Jerry became a right-winger. They think that he was a stockbroker. Actually, he was a moderate Democrat with a tie, much like his comrade Tom Hayden. And most importantly, I want to stress, he was not selling shares of Exxon on Wall Street. He was actually marketing in 1980 green energy, solar panels, and ecology. And that was one of the key reasons I wrote this book, is I wanted people to remember Jerry, that he wasn't a right-winger. He was actually a moderate Democrat.
There's anger at Jerry Rubin.
A lot of anger, because, you know, everyone believed in him. They kind of followed him into battle in 68. And then I think people felt cheated. But the other thing that I realized, that Jerry's arc is very much the same as many of his followers, which is in the 60s, early 70s, a radical. And then in the early to mid 70s, he gets into yoga and health food. He gets married. He has kids. He gets the BMW. He's still voting as a Democrat. So Jerry's arc is similar to most of his followers. But I think because he was famous, he took it on the head for that. And many of the people are critiquing them. They're sitting in their executive office, and I'm like, well, you're basically a Jerry Rubin, right?
Yeah.
You know, you shaved off your beard and you went to work for IBM. That's okay. You know. It's not a crime.
Well, tell me how you did research for this book. You talked to a lot of people.
Well, I kept,
who knew him. You traveled the country to do this.
Yeah, I kept very lucky. I reached out. Jerry died in 1994. I reached out to his widow, she had saved all of Jerry's belongings. Jerry never threw anything away. I had his canceled checks to Phil Oaks from like 1970, right? I had letters from Bernadine Dorn of the Weather Underground. And I also had Jerry's Rolodex. Now, obviously, the phone numbers had changed, but Jerry's family started calling Paul Krasner for me, Rennie Davis, Bobby Seale, right? All kinds of people. And so I literally called or flew around the country, and I really got a sense of who Jerry was from interviewing almost 100 people. And the last thing I want to say about that is women are very much left out of these stories, right? You see any documentary about the movement. I tracked down over 20 women, and Judy Gumbo, Nancy Kershaw, Kate Coleman, various women, and their voices are very clear in the book of their commitment and what they brought to the table in the 1960s.
Did you find that people's opinions of Jerry Rubin today are still mixed? I
found that the people that actually knew him still really liked him and admired him. Now, you know, sure, they had some beefs. I mean, you know, Jerry wasn't perfect. But the people that were closest to him in the movement of the 60s did not hold it against him that he got out. And, you know, one of the things that they said, look, Jerry was a public figure. Jerry could be walking down the streets of New York in 1970 and a hard hat would just come up and punch him right in the face. Right.
That happened.
So you can't blame Jerry for after about, you know, a decade of that to say, you know, maybe I want to do something else with my life.
Yeah.
You know,
did he ever talk about that? The transformation?
Well, he did. And what he believed in is kind of the classic, if you can't beat him, join him. He felt that as an entrepreneur and as a capitalist, he could kind of change the system. So in the 1980s, he was hooked up with Jesse Jackson. They went to Burger King and they said, you don't have enough black executives. You know, you don't see the big money guys of today worrying about how many black executives we have. So Jerry didn't lose his consciousness. He didn't lose his love of the disenfranchised.
Yeah. Tell me about his business dealings. How did he get into business? How wealthy?
Well, you know, the thing was is that no one really trusted Jerry. In fact, the best story I have is kind of a personal story. My brother's 10 years older than me. My brother was working on Wall Street in the 80s. My brother turned me on to Jerry, you know, 15 years earlier. Jerry comes in for an interview, and my brother said to his boss after Jerry left, he said, you know, we can't trust this guy. This is the guy who threw money on the New York Stock Exchange.
Yeah.
So Jerry had to invent kind of his own businesses. And so one of his first businesses in New York, you know, we take things like LinkedIn, Evite, Facebook for granted. He was throwing these parties in clubs where he said, okay, this Thursday, if you have an MBA, show up with your business card. And 1,500 to 2,000 people would do that. And it was a way for them to link in and get a job. Then he'd say, okay, 2 weeks from now, if you have an engineering degree, show up, right? And these parties were quite successful. And he actually started using the phrase social networking in like 1984. Now we take that phrase for granted. So Jerry was a little bit of a visionary. He sort of visualized Facebook and LinkedIn in real time, if you will.
Wasn't he an early investor into Apple?
No, he's not.
That's not true.
There's several things on that Wikipedia page. You know, he never invested.
Am I outing myself on Wikipedia here?
He never invested in computers, but he did see computers. He died in 94, just as things were starting to come, get going with email and thing. But, you know, he talked a lot about that with his friends. He said, you know, computers are going to be an incredible networking thing for us. In his final years, he was focused on longevity. His parents died in their 50s of, you know, ill health. And so Jerry was determined that he would live to be 100, became a hardcore vegetarian. He was marketing health food, drinks and vitamins and things. And unfortunately, he died in his 50s.
You got hit by a car?
Got hit by a car. He was in a coma for 2 weeks. And then when they opened him up, they did an autopsy and they found out that his body was filled with cancer.
Oh.
Ironically enough. But yeah, Jerry was a total health food nut in the last decade or two of his life.
Again, we are in conversation with Pat Thomas. Pat Thomas is the author of the book, Did It? From Yippie to Yuppie, Jerry Rubin and American Revolutionary. Pat Thomas has written other books, including Listen, Whitey, The Sights and Sounds of Black Power, 1965 to 1975. The title of your book, Did It, is a riff on Jerry Rubin's own book, which
That's
was
right.
Do It.
That's right. At the height of the Chicago 8 trial in 1970, he wrote several books, but his best-known book was called Do It. Later, Nike stole that phrase, you know, do it for one of their ads in the 90s. So I decided to call the book Did It because, you know, Jerry really did. You know, to me, I call him the quintessential American. You know, America was founded in, you know, patriotism and radicalism, right, in 1776. And that was definitely Jerry in the 60s. We, as Americans, we like to do a lot of self-awareness. And so, again, you know, in the 70s, Jerry's doing EST, health food, and yoga. And then, of course, you know, love it or hate it, you know, entrepreneurism, you know, and capitalism is also very American. And he's doing that in the 80s. So I see Jerry as sort of all the American dreams are right there in the life of Jerry Rubin from about 1966 to 1994.
What was it for you, though, that made you want to tell his story?
Empathy. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's easy for us to read about someone like Rubin or remember someone like Rubin and go, you know, like I said, call him a sellout or why did he do this or why did he do that? And, you know, Jerry right here in Berkeley in 1965 was one of those people that was laying down on the train tracks as, you know, the troop trains were going to the Port of Oakland. Jerry also found out that napalm was being made out in Livermore, and it was being trucked through Berkeley to the Port of Oakland. Of course, it was being trucked. You know, they didn't have signs that said this is napalm, right? He sussed out what those trucks were. He took a big old truck. He painted it battleship gray, and then he spray painted danger napalm, right? And he would follow these trucks all over the Bay Area, again, just to bring awareness. So, you know, I think it's important for us to remember these types of guys, Abby Hoffman, Jerry Rubin, Judy Gumbo, Stu Albert, you know, all, you know, Berkeley area people at various times. And, you know, just to remember, like, hey, as I mentioned earlier, you get hit in the head with a baton, you know, 30 or 40 times, you do a couple months of jail time, you know, you start to rethink. That's not to say Jerry gave up, but he just sort of shifted the way he wanted to do his life.
Do you think his philosophy, his politics changed?
His politics never wavered because he was always a liberal. In fact, the day that I'll call it the day that he died. I mean, he died a few weeks later, but the day he got hit by a car, he was sitting in his apartment with another former radical of the 60s. I'm blanking on their name. And Jerry wanted to figure out a way to put the disenfranchised black kids of Compton and L.A. into college, right? He was searching for another social political statement to make, and I think that's really important to remember that, you know, again, Jerry wasn't pushing shares of Exxon; he was pushing green energy and ecology, and he never really lost that vision. He just started to channel it through other means.
You know? You have an interesting quote in your book, Did It, from William Kunstler, the legendary attorney who represented him and others from the Chicago 8.
That's right.
About how he saw, you know, whether or not Jerry Rubin was a sellout.
Well, yeah, Kunstler wrote an obituary right after Jerry died, and he said a couple things. He said, first of all, whatever you think of Jerry, good or bad, in, you know, the 1990s, you cannot forget his incredible dedication to the movement in the 60s and 70s. And he also pointed out that Jerry, one of these, what do you call them, shock jock morning DJs, said we should set all the homeless people of Santa Monica on fire. And Jerry wrote to the FCC, and he said, this isn't cool. And around the time that Jerry got hit by a car, the Santa Monica City Council was passing laws about, you know, can you say something like this on the air? So Jerry always had that political integrity right to the end.
Where did Jerry Rubin grow up? And did he become his parents later on in life?
Well, Jerry grew up in Cincinnati, working class parents. His dad drove a bread delivery truck. After about a decade of that, his dad became the union rep for the truck drivers. Jerry was politicized by that. In other words, he saw his dad sort of working for the working class. He also was enamored with Adlai Stevenson. Jerry, when he was 16 years old, tracked Adlai Stevenson down and interviewed him when Adlai was running for president. And Jerry also noticed in Cincinnati that all of the African Americans lived on the other side of the tracks, and he started thinking about that. And then around 64, he's listening to the radio, and he's hearing Mary Osavo, you know, beaming out from here.
From UC Berkeley?
Yeah, Jerry got in a car, drove straight to UC Berkeley, enrolled in college as a grad student. He lasted 6 weeks. He dropped out, and he started following Mario around. Jerry helped found something called the VDC, the Vietnam Day Committee, which was sort of a branch of the free speech movement that was specifically focusing on Vietnam. And he never looked back, you know.
He was called in to testify to the House of Un-American Activities Committee.
This is one of Jerry's greatest moments. You know, when you think of HUAC, you think of Joseph McCarthy, you know, looking for commies. You think of all the careers that were ruined, right? Now, many brave people got in front of HUAC, refused to talk or whatever. Jerry rented a Revolutionary War uniform. He showed up as like Paul Revere, and he handed out copies of the Declaration of Independence. And much like he did when he shut down the New York Stock Exchange for a day, he shut down Congress for a day. They absolutely freaked out. They arrested him. They wouldn't let him testify.
They arrested him for what?
For just for being like shocking,
yeah,
right. And so that put Jerry on the front page of the newspapers. And interestingly enough, you know, we were talking about earlier that, you know, Abby in 2017 is more famous than Jerry. Yeah. Abby at that point hadn't done anything on that scale. And so when Jerry got to Manhattan a year later, Abby said, "I got to meet this guy. You know, this is my hero." So, you know, I thought that was kind of amusing.
Well, what did he say to it? Did he say anything to HUAC, or was he just arrested before?
As they were literally dragging him out, he said, "I'm here to testify. I'm here to testify."
Right.
And he had, not only did he have the Declaration of Independence, he had a whole, you know, thing that he wanted to say, and it's reproduced in my book. I can't remember it, but, you know, just his act of defiance.
Yeah.
And one of the things to remember, his wife was telling me this, you know, that was kind of a brave thing to do, because the night before he did it, he's laying in bed in a hotel room or wherever he was in Washington, D.C., and he's thinking, well, what if everybody laughs at me? What if the radicals think that I'm a moron? But instead, you know, I interviewed some of the White Panthers, John Sinclair of the MC5. They said, you know, this was the first guy to inject humor into the movement. We love this guy, you know, because, you know, the political rhetoric was great. You know, we could sit here and we talk about how the French got to Vietnam before we did or whatever. But what Jerry did sort of roped in the youth, because it was like, wow, this is funny. I think I want to know more about what's going on in Vietnam.
It's like a protest or early version of someone like a John Stewart or
a little bit of a John Stewart, a little bit of, you know, the Russian group of women, Pussy Riot. You know, I actually think in today's world that the comedians, if you will, the John Stewarts of the world are some of our best political spokespeople. And I see Jerry sort of in that lineage, because he's using comedy to make people realize that the Pentagon is foolish. You know, LBJ is foolish. One of Jerry's other great Berkeley legacies is Jerry put together something called a teach-in. And in 1965... 20,000 people stood at UC Berkeley outside for 36 hours and listened to Paul Krasner, Dick Gregory, Norman Mailer, Dr. Benjamin Spock, right? And it was all about why the Vietnam War was wrong. And this was something that Jerry put together along with a few other people, and that was like his vision. And it later came out as an album on Folkways, not the whole 36 hours, but a condensed version. And nobody at that time was ever able to do an event that had quite as many people as that. It was quite something.
Do you know how Jerry Rubin responded when he went down the road for business and became an entrepreneur, and the critiques that came to him being a sellout, these things, how he responded to that?
You know, that's a really good question. Obviously he was defensive. And I think he spent a lot of time trying to convince people that his basic core ideals had not shifted.
Was he able to use his humor to respond to that? Did he keep that humor?
I know, you know, he would say something. I mean, you know, he would treat each audience differently. You know, I actually just went and visited Jerry's high school in Cincinnati a few weeks ago. And in 1992, a couple years before he died, he came and gave a big speech there to the students. And, you know, a couple of the students, 17-year-olds, were harassing him about, well, dude, now you're a sellout. And he pointed at him. He said, look, I challenge you to go out and change the world. Let me know how it works out for you. And when you're done, come back and we'll compare notes.
Yeah. You know?
So that was his response to that particular.
How widespread was the anger at him, though?
Well, it was pretty widespread. I mean, I still see it on social media. When I announce I'm going to do a book event, someone always pops up and goes, oh, Jerry Rubin, the sellout. But it's generally people that didn't really know him. You know, I was really happy that the people that knew him, you know, had walked side by side with him and said, look, you know, Jerry has the right to change. And you know, he put on a suit and tie, but he didn't go right wing. But, you know, people, because he was such an iconic figure, you know, people don't want their icons to change. And yet, let's just pretend for a minute that Jerry didn't change. And let's pretend that he got depressed and, you know, he's sitting in a bar and he's got a scraggly beard and he's there in 1980. You'd be mocking him that he was like a washed up radical, right?
No
matter what he did, it was never the right thing for the public, you know? People mocked him when he put on that Revolutionary War uniform. People mocked him when he shaved off his beard and he decided to start eating health food. Like some radicals thought that was uncool, right? And Jerry said, what's uncool about wanting to be healthy?
Yeah.
You know?
But did he give up his outrageous behavior?
Well, yeah.
I don't know if you give it up, but I mean, did he stop?
Yeah.
His performance theater, maybe?
He did. Yeah. I mean, you know, he became a bit of a businessman. But, you know, he didn't completely lose his sense of humor. Like, you know, there was a very infamous Yippee Yuppie debates that took place in the 80s. Jerry and Abby toured the country.
That's right.
Yeah.
After he leaves the movement, now he's debating his former partner, co-founder of the Yippies.
Right. And one of my favorite things is each night he said, I'm Jerry Rubin. You may remember me from the 60s. I was known and unwanted in many states. I was the source of generation gap debates between teenagers and their parents. He goes, and then I shaved off my beard and nobody recognizes me anymore. And that's why I always carry my American Express card. And it was great. You know, people laughed because he was, you know, he had a sense of humor.
What did they debate?
Well, you know, they debated, you know, Jerry was looking forward. Jerry was already talking about computers in 1984. Jerry predicted that we would, you know, no surprise, eventually get a baby boomer president. You know, he sort of saw Clinton coming before Clinton came. You know, and Abby was, you know, sort of reminiscing a bit about the 60s. I saw Abby speak on his own in the 80s. You know, Abby became a little bit of a lost soul, you know. But one of the other funny things, you know, Abby's remembered for many, you know, great things. But one of the things I found out, Abby was so competitive with Jerry that at night, you know, after the debates were over and he got his, you know, check for $5 or $10 grand for doing his thing, he was calling up a former Weather Underground member who was selling foreign commodities in Chicago. And Abby was investing his money and he was making good money. He was making like $100 to $200 grand a year, right? And he was doing that sort of behind Jerry's back because he wanted to laugh and go, hey, I'm making as much money as Jerry is.
Right.
You know, and so, you know, again, I'm not saying this to, you know, blow Abby's cover, but, you know, Abby was not a saint and Jerry was not the devil.
Did they remain friends?
They did remain friends. A lot of people claim that they weren't, but close friends of Abby said to me, they said, look, Jerry always supported Abby when he was underground. He never, you know, blew Abby's cover. And for that, Abby loved Jerry right till the end.
Hmm. Pat Thomas, thank you.
Thank you, Mitch.
Again, Pat Thomas has been our guest. Pat Thomas is the author of the book, Did It? From Yippee to Yuppie, Jerry Rubin, an American Revolutionary.
That does it for Letters and Politics. Deanna Martinez is our producer, Lucille Rousseau is our intern, and Kirsten Thomas is our engineer. You can listen to our archive shows at kpfa.org. I'm Mitch Jezrich, and I thank you for listening.